gruesome. But if you want to, go to YouTube, you can find those. So that's what we think of. We think of lions and the fear that we normally have of lions when we think of the book of Daniel. Now, if someone wanted to get you into trouble, what would they use? I'm not talking about a false accusation. I'm talking about what could they use against you that you truly deserve, you know, that would be true. Some might say that there are two reasons we all come to church, either because we feel guilty or because we feel the need to feel guilty, and preachers are really good at helping us to feel guilty. Well, and those songs that we sing, as the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs after you. You alone are my heart's desire, and I long to worship you. Really? Can we honestly sing that song and many other songs like it? You know, is it really true? So do we sing them to make ourselves feel guilty? Well, before I lose you completely, what we are doing when we sing or we say those kinds of things is what we call aspirational. Is something that we aspire to be or that we aspire to feel. And it's actually not a bad thing if we believe, unless we believe, that we have arrived. And then we've got a problem. So we honestly need to be very aware of how far we have to come in order to get where we know that we need to be. Now, I know it sounds a little confusing, or a lot confusing when we say things like that, but we do understand it, right? We do understand that we're not here because we're perfect and we feel that perfect kind of faith, but it's something that we want to do, and that makes it okay to sing as if we've done it. But back to that original question. Besides calling you a hypocrite for singing and saying words that you don't really live up to like they could, that's not really a valid criticism unless you aren't even wanting and trying to live up to those words. But what could someone use against you to get you into real trouble, something that you're truly guilty of? Well, we should all be sincerely uncomfortable with that question, right? Because there's something. Maybe there's more than one something. So Daniel's colleagues and all of the other wise men of Babylon really wanted to get him into trouble with Darius, who was the new ruler of the Babylonian Empire, as we go into chapter 6. He took over after Nebuchadnezzar died, and then his son Belshazzar was what Nebuchadnezzar's son was called, and he was weighed in the balances and found wanting, as we saw last week. Well, Belshazzar's last official act was to make Daniel the third most powerful person in the empire. But then he died that night, Belshazzar did, and then Darius the Mede took over. Well, he apparently kept Daniel in the position that he was in, or at least close to it, but then Daniel was so good at his job that Darius was planning to set him over the whole kingdom. And so this makes Daniel the object of the envy and hatred of the other wise men of Babylon. So as long as Daniel is in the position that he's in, none of them can ever climb the ladder of influence and gain the riches and wealth and honor that they crave. So they have to find something that they can use against Daniel to get him out of their way. That's the problem. Well, that's why I want us all to ask that question. What would they find to use against me? Well, let's see what they found to use against Daniel. We'll start in the last verse of chapter 5, after Belshazzar has been weighed in the balances and found wanting. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. It pleased Darius to appoint 100 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should have should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Not sure what he could do during the day, but he tried his best to find a way to get Daniel out of this. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." Darius knew about Daniel's faith. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. So think about that. Daniel was such a good man that they couldn't find any legitimate accusation to bring against him. The only thing they can find, think of to use against him is his faith. So they came up with this evil trap. So the law that could not be changed only said that the violator would be thrown into the lion's den. It didn't say anything about lifting them out of the den, because that wasn't a possibility, or so they thought. Okay, so the lesson is dare to be a Daniel. So the kids can now be dismissed to their classes. Might want to talk about that just a little bit. Okay. So, as I said, the law that could not be changed only said that the violator would be thrown into the lion's den. It didn't say anything about lifting them out of the den, because that was not a possibility. They had not contemplated that, at least. But they also had certainly not contemplated what Darius might do if that happened, right? At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. In our culture, there tend to be three camps when it comes to sentences for the worst crimes, right? There are some who do not believe in capital punishment. And if that's because they don't believe that our courts are infallible and that innocent people are sometimes found guilty, you know, that's certainly an understandable position. But there are some who simply don't believe in harsh punishment at all. And there are others who believe that our sentences tend to be too lenient. Maybe we should even have the death penalty not just for murder, but for rape. Or for child abuse, certainly sexual abuse of children. Okay, but hardly anyone would argue that we should do what those ancient cultures tended to do with any punishment. Our Constitution actually forbids cruel or unusual punishment. Well, ancient cultures did their best to use the most cruel punishment that they could imagine. And the Babylonians, as we saw with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they used fire. And that is as scary as anything, as horrible sounding as anything to me. But the Medes apparently thought that lions crushing and eating a person was even more horrendous. And then the Romans used crucifixion for their standard executions, and it was horrific. But there were also many Christians later who were killed by lions for the entertainment of crowds in the Colosseum in Rome. So here's a valid question. If Darius knew and cared so much about Daniel, and he knew about his faith in God, as he obviously did, doesn't it seem like he would have spared the wives and children of those men who schemed against Daniel, that didn't fit with the character of Daniel's God? Doesn't it seem like he would have learned a little bit more about God's character, and he would have known that child sacrifice or violence of any kind against innocent people was an abomination to Daniel's God? Well, we'll never get an answer that feels completely right when it comes to some of the violence that was actually instructed by God in the Old Testament. So we must simply understand that whatever was commanded somehow was the most merciful outcome for the innocent people that fell under that, and was just punishment for the evil people in those cultures. That's all that we can say. But this was not in that same category. God did not command Darius to do what he did. And I don't believe that it was the right thing to do in the case of their families. But in the case of those who cooked up this plot against Daniel and tricked Darius into the trap that they set, this was actually justice. This seems to me to be perfect justice. They got exactly what they deserved. Can we agree on that? Well, Darius, however, was not exactly restored from the fallen state of all human beings to the intended state of all human beings that God wanted for us. He did not repent of his vengeful and violent ways and immediately start thinking and acting as God would have him think and act. God did deem his response as worthy for our benefit. Darius's response to this amazing act of God is here for us to learn from. Before we get to that, let's focus on what we learned from Daniel in this incident. The first thing that I want to point out is that faith is action, not reaction. I believe that all animals react, but only humans can actually act, can decide, I'm going to do something and go out to do it. I don't think a dog says, oh, I'm going to go look at the sunset. You know, they don't do that. They react to how we treat them or their needs, their physical needs. So Daniel did not react at all to the law, which he might have known was specifically designed to get him into trouble. I mean, look again. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Now, Daniel was a very smart guy. I think he could have come up with some clever scheme or just some adjustments to his lifestyle that might have kept him out of trouble. Don't you? I mean, maybe some window shades. You know, that would have been a good idea. Or, you know, get down to Home Depot, problem solved. Nobody knows what he's doing behind those window shades. Well, you know, there was no law that said that Jews were required to pray three times a day in an open window facing Jerusalem. That's not in the law. That's just something Daniel did. You could even argue that Daniel was a little like the Pharisees that Jesus criticized for praying just to be seen by men. Do you remember that? And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Well, Daniel was not a hypocrite. And he did not do what he did to be seen by others. We know that because he did not react and do things differently just because he knew that others were watching. See, if he had been doing it because he thought they might be watching, you know, then he would have reacted in another way. He didn't react because he knew that they were watching. He knew that they were watching. He simply did what he had always done. We have no evidence that he had made a vow even between himself and God to pray three times a day in his window as he faced Jerusalem. So what would be lost if he did his praying at night or in the back room? Or, you know, what would have been lost, you know, if he had just not been so overt about this whole faith thing? Well, what would have been lost is the opportunity that he had to provide Darius and all those who read what Darius decreed with a much more complete knowledge of the power and character of God. See, before this, Daniel's consistency and his faithfulness in prayer was very admirable. It was an act of simple faith, though. That was good. But it was this incident that made it much more than just a good, simple act of faith. We should learn from that and follow his example in some way. Probably not in the same way, but in some way. Consistent acts of simple faith. Think about it. There are lots of possibilities. Prayer at regular times is a good thing. Don't need to be seen by anyone. Coming to church is a good thing. Giving time and money to certain good works is a good thing. There are literally thousands of things that we can do as simple acts of faith. It's not necessarily what we do, it's why we do it that makes the difference. Although we should be as discerning as possible. I mean, try to do the best things possible as best we can, you know, as best we can determine what those best things might be. You know, one of my elementary school assembly programs had a story about two kids who had helped to provide signs out in a lake to warn boats away from the breeding grounds of goonie birds. You know, and it was just one example of good things that kids were doing. Well, a little kindergarten girl after the assembly told me on the way out that she had helped a worm across the sidewalk. And, well, it's a good thing to find the best things we can do. So I don't think we want to make worm rescue our life's ambition. Compassion, though, for any living thing is good, you know. And so I certainly told the little girl that what she had done was a good thing. But as we grow up, we want to do the best things that will do the most good for the most people and for all of God's creation. But in reality, we aren't always smart enough to know what is best. And that is not really what, you know, makes any one act of faith a greater thing than another act of faith. Do you know what does that? Well, you won't like the answer. Talked about it in class. Persecution. Persecution turns good things into awesome things if we are faithful. We do have to be faithful in doing those things, whether we are praised and honored for doing them or persecuted for doing them. Being praised and honored for acts of faith is good, but not reacting to persecution is great. Darius's response to God's faithfulness, which was only known because of what he saw when Daniel simply did what he had always done, didn't react, underscores the value of persecution when it comes from our faith. Listen to Darius's response. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. We can and will prosper during the reign of every evil leader and every good leader if we are faithful. Only God knows how the good and evil balances out in anyone, in any government. Our role is to do all the good that we can do and give the glory to God, who gives us the strength and the insight to do those things. We should pray for peace, but we should expect and actually welcome persecution. Jesus said a lot about this, and some of it seems contradictory maybe, but he said, for example, in the Beatitudes, in the first teachings that we have of Jesus, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Later on in Matthew, he said this, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." In John's gospel, Jesus explains this. "If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world. But I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you." Then we see that fulfilled when the church breaks out in the book of Acts, when Stephen was stoned for preaching about Jesus. Look at the result of Stephen being killed because of his faith. "On that day, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. And they preached wherever they went." And then later on we see in Acts, "Now those who had been scattered by the persecution that broke out when Stephen was killed traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, spreading the word only among Jews. Some of them, however, men from Cyprus and Cyrene, went to Antioch and began to speak to Greeks also, telling them the good news about the Lord Jesus." Okay, so we see what it took in order for the good news about Jesus to spread. It took persecution, but faithfulness in persecution. And Jesus' brother James fills out the personal benefits of persecution. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. So here are some things to learn from Daniel and Jesus' words about sacrifice and things to learn also from his followers. If you don't have a routine that revolves around your prayer life, develop one. Try to get it in that order. Our prayer lives should not revolve around our routine. Our routine should revolve around our prayer lives. Maybe that's not necessary to change much, but at least change the way you think about it. Okay? Secondly, do not pray without giving thanks. You remember Daniel didn't just ask for help. He prayed giving thanks to his God as he had always done. Things were not ideal for Daniel and his people. They weren't in the best of situations. They were in exile. They were in a foreign country. They didn't have their temple. They didn't have the freedom to worship as they were taught to worship. But he still prayed, giving thanks to his God. But also do ask for God's help. He also asked for God's help. That's what he was doing, giving thanks and asking for God's help. And then finally, do not ask for persecution, but do not pray for freedom from persecution. Pray for strength in persecution. Let's do that now. Our Father.